For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So we're going to continue on in Genesis, the book of origins. We're getting into the meat of the book now. We're in a section that focuses on Abraham. And in this chapter in particular, we're going to look at a very mysterious figure named Melchizedek and a pretty interesting war among nine different kings. Now, just to jog your memory, when the New Testament talks about Abraham, it describes him as the father of our faith. If you look in Hebrews 11 and James 2, Galatians 3, several places talk about him this way. And that's because when you think about Abraham, he really, more than any other figure in the Bible, preeminently illustrates what faith is. Like, if you want to know what it looks like to live a life of faith, or to wrestle with faith, or to grow in faith, this man's life is what you want to study. And so as we go through this part of Genesis focused on Abraham, we're going to keep coming back to this theme of faith. Now, today we're going to look at, like I said, warfare between kings in Genesis 14. It's pretty fascinating. I'm going to blow right through it. I'm just going to explain the events that are happening. And then we're just going to reflect on what does growing faith look like in Abraham's life as he reacts to these different events that we're going to cover. Okay, pretty simple. We're going to just explain what happens and then just go look at what does growing faith in Abraham's life look like. So let's dive in. So in Genesis 4, he starts out, it says, oh, and by the way, I'll just tell you right now, there are so many hard-to-pronounce place names and people names here. You know, I guess, you know, now that I think of it, none of you know how to pronounce them correctly, right? So I can totally blow it and no one's going to know. So, all right, I don't have to worry about it. I'm just going to dive in here. All right, about this time, war broke out in the region. King Amraphel of Babylonia, King Arioch of Elasar, King Chedorlaomer of Elam, and King Tidal of Goim fought against King Bera of Sodom, King Birsha of Gomorrah, King Shinab of Admah. This is my favorite one. King Shemeber, that's a cool name, of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, also called Zoar, in case you were curious. The second group of kings joined forces in the Sidim Valley, that is the Valley of the Dead Sea. If you look on a map of the ancient Near East, as you just consider all these people, there's nine different kings here. They're actually broken up into two different blocks. On the far east, you have Chedorlaomer. That was the main king. All these other kings are allied with him. So you got four kings in the east, five kings in a region around the Dead Sea in the west. And these are the ones that he's talking about. These two guys, these two power blocks, are going to war. Now, when I think about Chedorlaomer, I usually think of the Godfather. Because Chedorlaomer's kind of a bully. You know, it's like, let me make you an offer you can't refuse, right? Pay me money and I'll protect you. And there's the five kings. Who are you going to protect us from? I'll protect you from me. That's who. Right? That's called extortion. It's also called paying tribute or taxes. And what it is Chedorlaomer had levied taxes. He would stay away from these five kings as long as they paid up every year. And they did. For a while, they paid their taxes. For 12 years, they were subject to King Chedorlaomer, but in the 13th year, they rebelled against him. So the bill came due, and they said, screw it. We're sick of paying. And of course, that comes with consequences. That meant they had to start waiting to see how Chedorlaomer would respond. And it says a year later, Chedorlaomer and his allies arrived. Now, you couldn't just cut straight east or west across the Arabian Desert. You had to come up across the Fertile Crescent. And so Chedorlaomer's forces come down like this into the region where the five kings are. And he's coming looking to get his tax paid. He's going to punish some delinquent taxpayers. Well, these rebel kings of Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, Zeboim, and Bela prepared for battle in the valley of the Dead Sea. And so these guys know that they're going to have to face the music, the five kings. So they muster in this area, the valley of the Dead Sea, just south of the Dead Sea. It's a place you can still visit today. And they wait there and get ready to go. They pick the ground that they want to fight on, and they wait there for Chedorlaomer and his forces to show up. And so if you keep reading, he does. The four kings from the far east roll in, and then there's a battle. Watch this. Oh, yeah. Let's do that again. I want to see that. Watch that. Oh, that's such a cool battle. That took me a while to figure out. I hope you enjoyed that. So these five western kings fought against Chedorlaomer, Tidal, Amraphel, and Arioch, four kings against five. And unfortunately for the western kings, they lost. They went down to defeat. And it was pretty bad. It says, as it happened, the valley of the Dead Sea was filled with tar pits, and as the army of the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah were running away, so these five kings, they just leave the battlefield, some fell into tar pits while the rest escaped into the mountains. Okay, so back then, and it's still true today, they have these tar pits in this region. And a lot of people were just cut up and thrown into these pits. Others escaped. So this is a brutal, you know, ancient warfare. It's just hard to overstate just how bloody and brutal and tragic an event like this would have been. Well, it says the victorious invaders, the kings from the east, Chedorlaomer, they plundered Sodom and Gomorrah and headed for home, taking with them all the spoils of war and the food supplies. So they have all this plunder, all this booty from their victory, and they head north. They're starting to head back up around the Fertile Crescent all the way back east to where they came from. Well, yeah, you're probably starting to go, okay, it's the ancient world, and you know, this kind of thing was pretty common. People fought each other. They went to war. This happened all the time. So what is such a big deal? Why would the guy who wrote Genesis spend so much time talking about this battle? Well, here's why. This is why it's such a big deal. It says that those forces with Chedorlaomer also captured Lot, Abraham's nephew. Okay, now I get it. So there's all these ancient Near Eastern events, and Lot, Abraham's nephew, and so that whole family is swept up into it. That's why we're learning about this. Lot lived in Sodom and was carried off along with everything that he owned. So as Chedorlaomer's headed north, he's headed north with Lot and Lot's wife and their kids and all their possessions. Now, just a little backstory real quick on Lot. When Abraham left the Ur of Chaldees to come into this region, into the land of Canaan, Lot followed him. And they really took divergent paths. Abraham remained kind of a nomad, trusting God as he went from place to place. But Lot was really enamored with this fertile part of the Dead Sea Valley, and he wound up living in Sodom, which we'll find out in a few weeks was not a healthy place for somebody to live. And so they really took not just divergent geographic directions, but divergent spiritual directions. Nonetheless, when Abraham heard that Lot had been kidnapped by Chedorlaomer, he took action. Fortunately, it says one of Lot's men escaped, and he reported everything to Abram the Hebrew, who was living near the oak grove belonging to Mamre. The Amorite. Now, where is this oak grove? If you zoom in, so I'm zooming in on the left side of that map. It's right about here, a white circle on the bottom of the map. That's where this grove of oak trees was. So Abraham's hanging out there. He hears that his nephew Lot's been kidnapped. And he's kind of drumming his fingers, like, what am I going to do about this? It says, when he heard that his nephew had been captured, he mobilized 318 trained men who had been born into his household. Now, this is a little insight here into who Abraham was. This guy was a great chieftain. He wasn't just some dude wandering around. He was a tribal leader. He had his own militia. A couple hundred fighting men. And these guys decide, we're going to go track down Chedorlaomer and his confederacy of kings, and we're going to get my nephew back. It says they pursued Chedorlaomer's army until they caught up with him in Dan. And just to help you appreciate their capabilities back then, this is really pretty stunning. So Chedorlaomer and company, they head north with their booty, with Lot, with his family, up to this town called Dan. Abraham follows right behind. And that blue arrow, it's about 160 miles over rough terrain. Abraham tracks Chedorlaomer down. And it says he divided his men and attacked during night. So it was a surprise attack, and it had to be. Abraham, I mean, that's a pretty impressive home militia, over 300 fighters. But this was a confederacy of four city-states led by a guy who just defeated five kings. This is a suicide mission. This is nuts that he even tried to do this. But he did. He divided his men, and he attacked. I didn't animate that one, but there's the battle. So there's a second battle. I know you've been deprived. I'm sorry. Second battle up near the city of Dan, and it was a rout. Abraham and his men totally caught Chedorlaomer's forces off guard. They split. Chedorlaomer's army fled, but Abram chased them as far as Hobah, which is somewhere up there in the north, north of Damascus. And so that's where we're at so far. An amazing, stunning victory by Abraham and his militia. Unbelievable. He was actually able to go find and defeat Chedorlaomer, and Abraham recovered all the goods that had been taken, and he brought back his nephew Lot with his possessions and all the women and all the other captives. A smashing success. So at that point then, Abraham is traveling back to the oak grove. And as he's almost there, maybe 20, 30 miles from the oaks, he pauses and has a fascinating encounter with a very important person. And we're going to spend a little time, we're going to slow down and think about this. So after Abram returned from his victory over Chedorlaomer and all his allies, the king of Sodom went out to meet Abraham in the valley of Shaveh. That is the king's valley. Now, we know where this is. This is just a little bit west of Jerusalem. It's still there. And so he meets the king of Sodom, who had come up to greet him after his amazing victory. And it says he met Melchizedek. And now listen to the way this guy is described. Melchizedek, the king of Salem. He's a priest of God Most High. Now, Salem still exists today. It's known as Jerusalem. Okay, so Melchizedek was the king of Jerusalem. And it says, out of nowhere, this guy has no genealogy, nothing. He just appears. He's a priest of the God Most High, the same God that Abraham worshipped. You know, Melchizedek is aware Abraham's got his couple hundred fighting men. He's got all of Lot's family and the other people that he rescued. There's a huge entourage that's traveled 140 miles all the way back down south. They're tired. They're hungry. Melchizedek sees that, and he brings them out some bread and wine. And then what happens is just kind of hard to believe when you think about it. Melchizedek blessed Abram with this blessing. He said, "Blessed be Abraham by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who's defeated your enemies for you. And then Abram gave Melchizedek a tenth of all the goods that he had recovered. Now just think about what we're reading here. Abram was a great man, powerful man, undeniably, he was great. He had just conquered Chedorlaomer, who himself had conquered five other kings. This was a regional power broker. That's who Abraham was. He was a great patriarch. And yet, it's evident in this passage that Melchizedek was even greater. Now, how can I say that? Well, picture Abraham kneeling down before Melchizedek, and Melchizedek puts his hand on him. And he says, blessed are you, Abraham, by God Most High. You know, in the ancient world, fathers blessed their sons. The greater blessed the lesser. And then, not only that, but Abraham lifts his hands up to Melchizedek and offers him a tenth of all of his spoils. Right? He's paying tribute to Melchizedek. There's clearly, what we're seeing here is Abraham is clearly showing deference and respect for someone he perceives to be greater than himself. And I think it's striking, too, when you think about the way Abraham interacts with Melchizedek. It's striking to contrast it with a completely different attitude that he had toward the king of Sodom. Okay? So just to review, he was blessed by Melchizedek. He gave him a tenth of his spoils. Melchizedek is the greater. But look at what he says when the king of Sodom speaks. It says, the king of Sodom said to Abram, give back my people who were captured, but you can keep for yourself all the goods that you've recovered. You know, wow, you saved our whole civilization. Take what you want. Well, it says, Abram replied to the king of Sodom, I solemnly swear to the Lord God Most High. See, Abraham believed in the same God as Melchizedek. Creator of heaven and earth, I will not take so much as a single thread or sandal thong from what belongs to you. Otherwise, you might say, I'm the one who made Abraham rich. Abraham's like, no thanks, no interest. I'll accept only what my young warriors have already eaten, literally the food that's in their stomach. And I request that you give a fair share of the goods to my allies, these guys that came here and helped me. He's like, I want nothing from you. He didn't want to have anything to do with the king of Sodom. He didn't want the king of Sodom to think that it was he that he was looking to for support and help. He wanted to give all the credit for his victory to God Most High. And so, there's the story. Okay, I said we'd cover the events in chapter 14. We're done. That's the last verse in the chapter. What have we read? We've read that there was this king who was taxing five kings, that they rebelled and they were conquered. And in the midst of being conquered, Lot was captured and taken away. But Abraham, against all odds, tracked that powerful army down, rescued Lot, and on his way home, had this really bizarre interaction with Melchizedek, somebody far greater than him. And he also created distance between himself and the king of Sodom. That's it. That's the story. Let's think about faith and just how the concept of faith interacts with everything that I've just covered. And I just want to, just to be sure we're on the same page here, when I talk about faith, I mean, it's essentially, like, the closest synonym is trust. It's a trust so strong in someone that you're willing to depend on them. So you think about this little girl jumping off a dock. Think about, what would it take for her to do that? She'd have to have trust so strong in her father's arms to catch her that she was willing to launch herself off the dock. That's a perfect picture of faith. It's a willingness to act, depending on God to come through with his promises. You think about how you became a Christian. If you're a Christian, this is what it involved. You realize I've got a weight of sin. I've done things that offend God. I could never work that off. I could never clean myself up. The only way I could ever deal with that would be to go to God himself and just ask him to lift that burden off my shoulders. And the only way to do that is to appeal to Jesus, to appeal to his son who died for us, and depend on him to forgive us. So there's got to be that, there was that willingness to appeal to Christ for forgiveness, and we've depended on him to make it possible. You know, you see the same kind of thing too, though. It's not just we do this once. God's really committed to growing. As you sit here, if you're a Christian, he's really committed to your growth in faith. You know, Abraham was a piece of work. He was not a perfect example of faith. He tried to pawn his wife off as his sister to protect himself. There's another time when God had made a promise to Abraham, and Abraham completely just quit believing it was true. He had a lapse in faith. He was a work in progress. And if there's any lesson you could pick up, you know, that jumps off the page, if you read Genesis yourself, it would be this. It would be that God is patient and committed to working with you over time to develop your faith. That's what we see him doing with Abraham. And so that's what I want to just ask, just the simple question. What does it look like when we see faith growing in the life of someone who follows God? What does that actually look like? Just three things. One thing is obviously growing faith is active. What would it have taken for Abraham to lead a ragtag militia of people from his own household and take on four city-states and their armies? It would have taken tremendous faith in God's promise to protect him. Now, if you remember in Genesis 12, God made a lot of different promises to Abraham. And one of those promises was to protect him. He said, "I'll bless those who bless you, Abraham, and I'll curse those who treat you with contempt." And so when Abraham just took off from his oak grove and decided, "I'm going to pursue Lot and take on Kedolomer," that wasn't self-will, and that was not a suicide mission. That was a rational choice to depend on God to protect him and give him victory. It was a faith step. That's what we've just read, is a guy who really trusted this promise, acting in faith that it was true. That's what we've just read. You know, a lot of times when people think about faith, they have a really passive perception of it. They just think it's, you know, it's like this phrase, let go and let God. Faith is when I just kind of put my brain on my shelf and go in autopilot and let God do everything, I do nothing. But that is not the type of faith we're reading about here. This type of faith in Abraham was very active. He was willing to actually make the 160-mile journey, put his whole life, everything at risk, to trust God in this promise. He was willing to act. So yeah, that is a huge thing. I mean, I don't want to, this is kind of a tricky balance to strike. I'm not saying that God didn't play a crucial role. I'm not saying it was all Abraham act. That's not true. Even Melchizedek, when he came up to Abraham, look at what he says. He says, "Blessed be God Most High, Abraham, who has defeated your enemies for you." So it's crystal clear, God and God alone is the one who made this victory possible. And yet, it never would have happened unless Abraham was willing to act. And so there's just a lot of things in our life where we have a sense that God wants us, you know, to move towards somebody, to have a difficult conversation, or to start a new venture in serving people, and we feel a pit in our stomach. We're not sure it's going to work out. But we can go to promises, different things that God has said are true, that he'll come through on. And then we have that decision. Am I sure enough? Do I trust God enough to come through on those things? Enough that I'm willing to act. That's what faith is all about. That's a healthy indicator that somebody's growing in faith, that they're taking scary steps of faith like this. Another thing that growing faith looks like is that it involves wherever you see growing faith, it will be tested. You know, this is the test for Abraham. Remember, Abraham's coming back from that battle with Chedorlaomer. He's traveled 160 miles. He's got not just himself, not just his warriors, but this huge entourage of captives with him. They're tired, they're hungry, their resources are depleted. And in that point of need, the king of Sodom shows up with this, what it had to be an appealing offer. He said, "Give back my people and you can keep all the goods that you've recovered." Now this had to be attractive for a couple reasons. One reason is that Lot was a butt. Lot was a selfish taker. If you read Genesis, you'll soon find out that Lot was not the kind of nephew you'd want to have. And this was an opportunity to just cut him loose and let him go. The other thing, though, is that it took a lot for Abraham to go get Chedorlaomer. And this was a chance from the king of Sodom to replenish his resources. And it must have been incredibly tempting. And this is the way it is a lot of times. When we take a step of faith, when we're in the middle of like growing and getting excited and serving God, a lot of times when we're in a point of need, some alternative will come up. You know, we look at this chapter, you know, some chapters we'd look at Abraham's faith, probably give him a C. But he gets an A+ in chapter 14. There's evidence he's growing like crazy in his faith. And it's at those times, a lot of times, that a test of faith comes. This is kudzu. It grows like, I think they say a foot a day when it's really like growing quickly. 60, 70 feet in one growing season. So it's just unbelievable. It overwhelms everything. And there are times in our life as Christians when we're growing like this. I can remember stretches where I just couldn't get enough Bible study. I was super excited about what I was learning. I was talking to people about my relationship with God. I was learning about the concept of spiritual gifts and how God's built us with different unique ways that we're empowered to serve him. I was pumped. I was growing. And you probably can remember stretches like that as well. And it's during those times in our lives, a lot of times, that we get tested, especially when we're growing. If you're here and you're excited about serving God, excited about learning about God, being with God's people, that's awesome. But a test is coming. And it often comes in the form of a very appealing opportunity. It's not always like snort a line of this or drink a bottle of that. A lot of times what derails our faith is something that is a very appealing opportunity. And what it involves a lot of times is an opportunity to do something that looks great, but that will displace God as the first priority in our lives. You know, if you look at the Bible's clear. We all have a mission, just like Abraham. God wants us to be in community with each other, to be sharing our faith with people, to explain to them how to know Christ. He wants us to be growing closer to him, to learn his word, to find ways to serve. If there's any situation you find yourself in and you're not able to do those things, it's difficult to put God first because that's what he's left us here to do. That's kind of the core of the Christian life. And there are times, though, when we get opportunities that would be awesome, but that would make those priorities impossible. It might be a romantic relationship with somebody who has no interest in following God. It might be a job, a career offer. It could be better pay and it could be better benefits. And the only drawback is it's going to be on the coast where you've already wanted to live for your whole life. It could be all those things. And yet when you start to realize, well, I don't know of a good church out there. I don't know what other Christians I could hang out with. I'm not sure what ministry opportunities would be there. I don't know if I could continue doing the kind of things I've been involved in. You start to realize, wow, perks, money, a travel, a great job, a blessing from God? Maybe not. Maybe a test of faith. Maybe something that could weigh down our faith. All I'm saying is, you know, as we walk around in the world and just kind of living our lives, there will be times when there'll be a great deal on a house or an awesome new career or some other incredible opportunity, and it will be a blessing from God, and it will enhance our ability to serve other people, and it will be awesome and something that God's put in our lap, but not always. We have to have a category. I don't know if you have a category for opportunities that come your way that are going to weigh your faith down. A house with a mortgage so high that all you have time to do is pay that mortgage. So you have no time, no resources, no energy to do anything else but that. There are going to be things that God has given us, and there's going to be things we need to say no to if we want to stay vitally focused on following God. That's part of growing faith, is recognizing a test of faith when it comes. This is Alan Ross. He's reflecting on why Abraham said no to the king of Sodom. He says Abraham wanted something far more enduring than possessions and wealth. He wanted the fulfillment of God's miraculous and enduring promise. Faith looks beyond the riches of this world to the grander prospects God has in store. Abraham intended to receive everything from God and not even a thread from Sodom. Obedient believers frame their lives so that for all success, joy, comfort, and prosperity, they depend on God. They look to God. So that phrase, not a thread from Sodom. God, I'm looking to you. I'm putting my chips on your square. I'm going to focus on your priorities and let you take care of me. And if I recognize something from you, I'll take it. And if I see something that's not going to allow me to pursue those priorities, I'm going to let it go. We've got to have a category for both things. All right. Here's something that I think is evident. I think long before Abraham encountered the king of Sodom, I think he had decided in his heart, I will entrust myself to God. If you read the last four verses of this chapter, he had already thought this through. And I just wonder, you know, if you're a spouse, if you have kids, have you sat down and thought through, like, what are our priorities? What are the non-negotiable things in our family's life, in my life, things that involve prioritizing serving God, things that I don't want to let go of, that I want to have time for, that I don't want to be knocked off of. I think it's important to settle that in advance. And I think one clear application is just asking, can you remember kind of just sitting down with the Lord and saying, I want to keep pursuing this, because I trust that you're good. I think that's a crucial lesson from what we're seeing here. All right, one more aspect of growing faith, and that is it has an impact way beyond our lives. Now, see if you can follow me on this. This is pretty fascinating what happens. What we just read happened in 2100 BC, over 4,000 years ago, between Abraham and Melchizedek. After this, the name Melchizedek fades away from the Bible. We don't hear anything about Melchizedek, not until 1,000 years later, when King David has a vision. He has a vision where he sees Yahweh interacting with the Messiah, and the name Melchizedek comes up again. You can read about this in Psalm 110. It says, the Lord, and if you look in Hebrew, that's God's proper name, Yahweh. It says, the Lord says to my Lord. Now, that's not David. He's writing this. And that's not Yahweh. He's speaking. This person he's referring to that David's talking about, this is the Messiah. This is this anointed ruler that's going to come and establish his reign over the entire world. And so Yahweh is speaking to the Messiah. And he says that this is the kind of thing you would say to an anointed ruler. Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. The Lord will stretch forth your scepter from Zion, saying, rule in the midst of your enemies. Okay, so this is what David hears is Yahweh telling the Messiah his vision of ruling in the future. And then Yahweh says something very important to the Messiah. He says, the Lord has sworn and he won't change his mind. You're a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Now remember, Melchizedek was a priest. And there's an eternal priesthood here. And he's saying the Messiah, this coming king, who eventually is Jesus, is a priest in the order of Melchizedek. And just real quick, some of us may not be that familiar with the concept of a priest, so let me try to explain. A priest acts as an intermediary between God and people. So if you went to a really nice restaurant, like Marcella's in the Short North, you can't just go back to the kitchen and go find a cook and tell him or her what to make. You can't just get up out of your seat and go back there and say, I want a grilled cheese sandwich. You have to interact with your server. You tell your server what you want, and then he or she tells the cook, and then the cook gives the food. The server's like your priest, okay? Maybe this would help. This is what I remember from junior high. There's a pretty girl, and I can't directly talk to a cute girl. I can't do that. And so I write a note, and I give it to my friend to give to that girl. He's like my priest. He takes it. I hope she accepts my sacrifice. And then he comes back and tells me how it went. I need an intermediary. That's all that a priest is. Now, in the Bible, it's really clear we need an intermediary between us and God. People and God, we need a priest because of something called sin. We've done things that offend God. We can't be in his direct presence. Actually, that's been tried. One guy, reading Leviticus 10, he tried to walk right into God's presence. Didn't go well. He died. See, check that animation out. How about that? You can't do that. This separation between us and God, it's a real thing. It's a real thing because of this moral issue. He's morally perfect, and we're stained by all kinds of sin. And so to be able to approach him, we have to have a priest. Now, in the Old Testament, they had these guys called Levitical priests, and they could go into God's presence and come back again. You want to see that again? It's pretty cool. Into God's presence, and they lived. They didn't die. They had to follow special procedures, but that's what they did. Now, usually they would take an animal on behalf of the people, usually a lamb or a goat, and they would go and offer it to God. And God would take that animal as a symbolic covering, a payment for the sin of the people. Okay, and so you've got to remember, this is the way it was for hundreds of years in the nation of Israel. They worked through these Levitical priests who offered sacrifices, and they had to have this certain pedigree. They had to be from the tribe of Levi. Not just anybody could be a priest. You had to have the right biological credentials. You had to be a Levite. That's why it's a Levitical priest. Well, anyhow, if you're tracking with me, the Messiah is also a priest. Doesn't have to be from the tribe of Levi. He's a priest, didn't it say in Psalm 110? He's a priest in the order of Melchizedek. And not only that, we talked earlier about how Melchizedek is greater than Abraham. He blessed Abraham. He received a tribute from Abraham. The Messiah, the priest in the order of Melchizedek, he's greater than all the Levitical priests. Interesting. Now, the other thing that's a huge difference is the Levitical priest offers animals. What does the Messiah offer? Well, we find out in Isaiah 53, and then we see in Jesus' life, he offers himself. That's what he offers. His own life for you, for your sin, for my sin. And so let's go back and think about these passages that mention Melchizedek. You know, what's the big deal here? Well, remember, 2100 BC, Abraham mentions Melchizedek. Then we've got 1000 BC, David and Melchizedek. Another 1,000 years go by until we get to the third and final, the only other place in the whole Bible where Melchizedek is mentioned. He comes up again in the book of Hebrews. Just these three places in the whole Bible. And the whole book of Hebrews is written to persuade Jewish Christians, give up on Levitical priests. You don't need to offer a lamb. Jesus is the Lamb of God. You don't need a human priest. Jesus is your eternal priest. You don't need an animal sacrifice. Jesus offered his own life for you. So the whole thing is arguing, you don't need Levitical priests anymore. And so if you're a Jew and you've been using Levitical priests for 1,500 years, what would you say? You would say, hey, Jesus isn't a Levite. He doesn't have the right pedigree to be a priest. Jesus can't offer an animal sacrifice in the temple. He's dead. And he's up in heaven now. He's alive in heaven, but he's not on earth. He can't go in and offer a sacrifice. And so if you're writing the book of Hebrews, how could Melchizedek help you out? Well, let's think about this. Jesus, the Messiah, is a different kind of priest. A priest in the order of Melchizedek. And not just any priest, a priest greater than all the Levitical priests. And he didn't just offer animals over and over again as a symbol. He offered his own life as the real thing. And so what we have in three passages separated by 1,000 years, in only these three parts of the Bible, we have ironclad proof that Jesus is adequate to be our priest forever. That's pretty amazing. That's one of the reasons why the Bible is such a special book. And so remember I said that growing faith has an impact way beyond our lives? How important was it for Abraham to go ahead and take a plunge and rescue Lot and to eventually meet Melchizedek and have this conversation? How huge was that? What's the impact of that? The impact of that is now sitting here today, we can dispense with elaborate rituals mediated by human priests. If you're in this room right now and you're wondering, what would I really need to do to be right with God? You have to do nothing but this. Go straight to Jesus, your priest, and go to him to be your mediator and ask him to deal with this obstacle of your sin, and he'll do it. That's all you have to do. You don't need a human priest. You don't need a bunch of elaborate hoops to jump through. And if you don't believe me, the Bible itself is very clear on this. It says a different priest who is like Melchizedek has appeared. Jesus became a priest not by meeting the physical requirement of belonging to the tribe of Levi, but by the power of a life that can't be destroyed. The psalmist pointed this out. This is Psalm 110. When he prophesied to the Messiah, you're a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. There were many priests under the old system, for death prevented them from remaining in office. But because Jesus lives forever, his priesthood lasts forever. Therefore, he is able, once and forever, I love that phrase, to save those who come to God through him. So how about it? That's the answer to the weight of guilt that we feel. It's going straight to Jesus and him alone for the forgiveness that we need. All right. So yeah, I hope you can see the ripple effect. It makes a big difference. when we're willing to act in faith. Every one of our lives has been touched by this. And so many, you know, I wish we had more time to talk about other examples, but I'm just telling you, one of the rewards of knowing God, we don't know specifically what the actual rewards are, but one thing we do know, here's one thing about it we know, is God is going to help us see the way our faith decisions have impacted other people. And when that day comes and he does that, it will blow your mind. Imagine how much this is going to blow Abraham's mind. That same principle is at work in your life as well. So, all right. Growing faith, it's active, it'll be tested, and it has an impact beyond our lives. I think that's it.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.